Good morning. It's Thursday, August 1st. I'm Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, what the latest escalations in the Middle East mean for a ceasefire deal, violence in Venezuela as voters call the election rigged, and the American long-distance swimmer who can't be beat. But first, in the U.S. election, both candidates are trying to court Black voters, though they're doing it in very different ways. Yesterday, Trump spoke to a conference of Black journalists where he tried to make the case that he's the president that will bring jobs to Black Americans. But he also made a false claim about his presumed opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris.
She was always of Indian heritage, and she was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was Black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn Black, and now she wants to be known as Black. So I don't know, is she Indian or is she Black?
Now, to be clear, Harris is Black and Indian. She has always identified this way. She speaks often about her Indian mother. She went to a historically Black university, is a member of a Black sorority, and was a member of the Congressional Black Caucus when she was a senator. Hours after those comments from Trump, Harris spoke at an event in Houston for Sigma Gamma Rho, a prominent Black sorority.
This afternoon, Donald Trump spoke at the annual meeting of the National Association of Black Journalists. And it was the same old show. The divisiveness and the disrespect. And let me just say, the American people deserve better.
Yesterday, just as Trump was taking the stage at the National Association of Black Journalists, I was speaking with the Wall Street Journal's White House correspondent, Catherine Lucey. She told me just how much the energy has shifted among Black voters in the race. If they were once on the fence about the election and their choices, many, she says, are now fired up. She was at Harris's rally in Atlanta on Tuesday night, and she said you could feel it in the crowd.
I have not seen such an enthusiastic Democratic event in years. People were lined up hours in advance inside the arena. The crowd was roaring when she came out. It took several minutes for them to quiet down for her to start speaking. They were chanting lines back at her in a way that we see at Trump rallies and we used to see at Bernie Sanders rallies, but we really haven't seen with Democrats in a long time. Mm. And there really was a feeling, I think, in the room that they had reharnessed momentum, that there was a chance, that there was a path forward. And a lot of real excitement, and I heard this a lot from women and women of color, a real excitement about seeing a woman of color on the ticket in this way, that this was a first, that this was historic. So there was really a lot of emotion in the room.
You know, polling was showing that Georgia seemed out of play for Democrats when Biden was still the nominee. Does it seem like voter sentiments in the state are shifting now that Harris is at the top of the ticket, most likely?
Certainly, it seems like enthusiasm is shifting. So there was a sense that at least some Democrats thought Georgia was out of reach with Biden. You know, many had written the state off. Trump had held polling leads in the state for a long time, even though Biden had won the state narrowly in 2020. But as Harris got out of the gate, you know, enthusiasm has really exploded for her, particularly with the coalition that elected Biden. So young voters, voters of color, particularly Black voters, we're seeing a lot more enthusiasm.
Let's talk about some of the mobilization efforts that we've seen. Hours after Biden dropped out of the race, more than 44,000 Black women and allies got onto a Zoom call, and they raised over $1.5 million for Harris. Days later, we saw Black men organizing in a very similar way. Can you describe the energy that we are seeing among Black voters right now?
This energy is off the chart. I talked to a woman in Atlanta last night who said, you know, she missed out on participating in organizing for Barack Obama. She wasn't going to do it again. She'd already bought shirts. She'd started going door to door to register voters. You know, this was her first political rally. People are very, very excited. I mean, a lot of them were prepared to vote for Joe Biden, but the enthusiasm is completely different here.
Hmm. We're also seeing Harris engaging with a bunch of Black sororities. She, of course, is a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha herself, aka she's been meeting with Divine Nine fraternities and sororities. Last night, she met with Sigma Gamma Rho in Houston.
It is so good to be with you this evening, and I say that as a proud member of the Divine Nine. And when I look out at everyone here, I see family.
Talk to me a little bit about the role of sororities and fraternities here, and the power that they have.
Yeah, these are really powerful organizations. Black sororities are powerful networks of women in a lot of these key battleground states. I met a former AKA member at the Atlanta rally, you know, who was saying how Harris was standing on the shoulders of AKA members going back generations who have, you know, fought for civil rights. This is a network that is unique to Harris. We have seen her when she was the number two on the ticket. She was very focused on campaigning and traveling to historically Black colleges and universities, speaking in urban centers. And so she has long courted that part of the party, and she has close relationships there, and those are clearly meaningful.
Let's talk about the Trump campaign strategy for a moment. We know that the campaign has been trying to get Black and Hispanic men, specifically under the age of 40, into their camp. And at least when Biden was still the candidate, they felt like that strategy was going pretty well for them. How have they pivoted, if at all, with Harris now in the race?
That's right. The Trump campaign really saw openings with younger Black men and men of color. They saw that there was not a lot of enthusiasm for Biden, and they were really trying to make an economic message to those voters. I think the question now is whether that is still effective. Trump is continuing to make a play for those voters. He'll be back in Atlanta at the same venue Harris was campaigning at this week for his own rally. His campaign argues that they can continue to make an economic argument. And Republicans that I talked to in Georgia, you know, said that they don't think that there's suddenly going to be some giant change in the trajectory of the race. The question now is, will Harris be a more effective messenger than Biden was?
Catherine Lucy at The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Moving on to world events that are going to have an impact on President Biden's remaining months in office. In a matter of just a few days, Biden has been confronted with two major foreign policy crises. The first is the escalating situation in the Middle East. The second is a power grab by Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro. Let's start with the Middle East. Iran and Israel are exchanging threatening words after the dual assassinations of a Hezbollah commander in Lebanon and a Hamas leader in Iran. Israel has so far only taken responsibility for the first, but Iran's supreme leader has vowed revenge, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel will, quote, settle the score with anyone who harms us.
These reports over the last 48 hours certainly don't help with the temperature going down. I'm not going to be Pollyannish about it.
That's White House spokesperson John Kirby, who said the White House is continuing to push forward with ceasefire talks to end the war in Gaza.
When you have events, dramatic events, violent events caused by whatever actors, it certainly doesn't make the task of achieving that outcome any easier. Again, we still believe there's a viable process. We still believe there's interested counterparts. And we still believe that there are meetings and discussions to be had.
One thing to note, the Hamas leader who was killed, Ismail Haniyeh, was among the negotiators in the ceasefire talks. The Qatari prime minister posted on X shortly after the killing that it was impossible to negotiate a ceasefire if one party is assassinating the negotiators of the other party. Even though Biden is a lame duck president, there is so much riding on finding a solution to the Gaza war. Beyond the huge humanitarian costs that are being paid, there are just 3 months to go until the election. An escalation at this stage could be politically disastrous. As if that crisis isn't big enough, the situation in Venezuela is also volatile and could potentially see a ripple effect into American politics. Multiple people died during protests this week after critics say authoritarian leader and current president Nicolas Maduro stole the election that took place over the weekend. The country's election authority has refused to release the full results for an independent review, and critics say their results don't add up, that it's statistically impossible. Here's White House spokesperson John Kirby again.
our patience and that of the international community. It's running out on waiting for the Venezuelan electoral authorities to come clean and release the full detailed data on this election so that everyone can see the results.
To understand how Venezuela could impact the next election in the U.S., you have to go back a few years. The Trump administration imposed harsh sanctions on Venezuela that contributed to the country's economic collapse. Nearly 8 million Venezuelans left the country, and many of them came to the United States. Trump also backed an interim president who tried, unsuccessfully, to seize power from Maduro. When Biden came into office, he eased those sanctions in exchange for promises from Maduro to allow free and fair elections. They were just recently reimposed, and look at where things stand today. There are no signs of Maduro standing down. He faces drug trafficking and corruption charges in the United States and is wanted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. Should he concede power, he could end up behind bars. And he has the backing of other strongmen, including Vladimir Putin, who told Maduro this week that he's always welcome in Russia. If Maduro remains in power, one poll conducted in June estimates that a third of the people remaining in Venezuela would try to leave, and it's likely many of them would come here to the U.S. CNN spoke with a fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations who said this could be a really bad October surprise for the Democrats. Before we let you go, here's a roundup of some notable moments from the Olympics. American swimming phenom Katie Ledecky did it again.
And the greatest swimming machine we've ever seen rolls off to another gold here in Paris with a new Olympic record.
She won gold and set an Olympic record Wednesday night in the 1500-meter freestyle. It's one of the two races she has long dominated. And just to say, she set the world record for it six different times. Yesterday's victory gives Ledecky her eighth gold medal and her 12th medal overall. Meanwhile, the U.S. women's soccer team won their third group stage match against Australia, advancing to the knockout stage. Don't call it a comeback yet, but it's a massive turnaround from their performance in last year's World Cup. Today, track and field events kick off, starting with men's and women's speed walking. And you might notice something different this year. The track is purple. It's a nod to the sustainability theme at the Paris Games. The Athletic explains how traditional tracks are made out of calcium carbonate, which is typically extracted through mining. But this year's track is made out of recycled seashells. Same material, no mining needed, and it works just the same. In fact, with each Olympics, as we see improvements in the technology behind track material, we see more records getting broken. So we could be in for some super fast speed walking today. And finally, Egyptian fencer Nada Hafez reached the round of 16 earlier in the week. And as she revealed on Instagram, she did it while 7 months pregnant. Hafez posted, "What appears to you as two players on the podium, there were actually three." She went on to say that the journey to get there has been challenging, both physically and emotionally. But she's proud to be at the Olympics for the third time and to be carrying a mini Olympian inside her. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the news app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Bloomberg Businessweek looks at an LLC buying up bankrupt businesses that were once household names and reviving them based on their brand recognition. If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.